Okay, so this is lecture number 5 of the 8 I shall be giving you. And we're going to talk about instruments today. So this first slide gives you a kind of overview of the history of seismic instrumentation. So you can imagine a couple of centuries ago, people didn't understand what caused earthquakes. So, you know, under those circumstances, they can perhaps be forgiven for thinking, you know, how they could be measured or whether it was of any use measuring them at all. I mean, if you had some notion that occasionally earthquakes would happen and this shaking of the ground was kind of a bit like wind, except it was in the ground, then, you know, you might think, well, we're not going to learn anything by measuring this. But, so, you know, although you may wonder, you know, think, oh my goodness, you know, it was so late in the day when people measured these things, it's sometimes quite difficult to put yourself in the shoes of the people of the time. So, in fact, the first attempt to detect earthquakes in any sort of systematic way occurred in China in the year 132 AD. So it was a long way away, long time ago. And then there were 17 or 18 centuries of the Dark Ages, and nothing was done, and then people started to take more of an interest in actually getting some recordings, and they set up devices which didn't make a permanent record but were making marks in sand and that kind of thing in response to a pendulum moving. But it wasn't until about 100 years ago that people started making devices that gave a permanent record, and the oldest known seismogram dates from 1887, and a lot of this early work was done in Italy. Interestingly enough, there was quite a big surge of activity from 1887 right up to the turn of the century in 1900. And in 1900, the first global array of seismographs was set up. So I was kind of reading this lecture over this morning, freshening my mind of its contents. And I thought to myself, well, where did they get the funding from? You know, people would have said, what's the point of doing that? It's not going to stop earthquakes. And it would have been taken quite a lot of effort and money to develop these instruments and then make them and set them up. So it's be quite curious to go back and look at that history. It's difficult enough to get research money for something which is demonstrably useful nowadays, let alone something that's just a kind of hobby thing. But anyway, electromagnetic sensors were first developed around about 1914, and of course things progressed and became quite sophisticated after that. So maybe you've seen this picture before. This was the 132 AD Chinese instrument, and the original instrument is not preserved, but this replica has been made from the written descriptions. So it had got a mechanism inside it, and there were these dragons here which had balls in their mouths, and when the seismograph moved, when the ground moved, the dragon's mouths would open, and the ball would fall out and pop into the frog's mouth. So you could tell the direction from which the seismic waves came by looking to see which frogs had got balls in their mouths and which hadn't. So inertial pendulum systems, these are the ones that we're interested in, and essentially all seismographs work on this principle, not all. Piezoelectric sensors are starting to be developed, but most sensors essentially work on this principle where you have some kind of a frame which is fixed to the ground. There's a spring with a weight on the end, a bit like a gravimeter. When the ground moves, then the mass bobs up and down, and a pen will make a recording on some kind of paper. Because we don't want this mass bobbing up and down for ages, it's damped by some mechanism. So that's basically how it works. And a few years ago, I had the privilege of being invited to the Azores to give a talk on why I thought plumes don't exist. But anyway, I was given a tour of the local seismograph station. I like exploring old buildings, and I had a good poke around and discovered that they had an extensive basement, which they didn't usually show people around because it was all dirty and messy. But down in this basement, they'd got all sorts of amazing stuff away. They're quite a little museum, so I took a few pictures. And this is a piece from one of the earliest seismographs, the Milne seismograph, dating from 1902. And what on earth is this? And I pulled up a diagram of this seismograph, and this little device here, which is all that was left of the seismograph, was the roller system that the paper went around. So here we have the ground, if you like, and here we have an arm, horizontal arm. When an earthquake occurred, this arm would sort of move in and out of the paper, and it would write a record on paper, which was continuously rolling around these rollers. But they also had some later instruments too. So this is an ancient inertial pendulum seismometer. It's a horizontal instrument as well. So here we have a heavy mass on an arm. And horizontal ground motion would cause this arm to swing in and out like this. And it would move this pen here, which was drawing a line on paper taped onto this roller. So this roller was continually turning 24 hours a day by a little motor, and when some motion occurred, there would be a trace written. So you've already looked at some paper records of this sort. So here's a picture of it from another angle. You can see that it's all black and messy. And here is another one in the corner here. And the reason it's all black and messy is because what was done was to tape a piece of paper on this drum. And you then lit a lamp here, an oil lamp, and this oil lamp would let off a lot of black smoke, and you spun this thing around in this cloud of smoke here, and the paper would become covered with soot. You would then lift it very carefully, and you would replace the used piece of paper with a clean, sooted piece of paper, okay, and you start the thing going afresh, and can anybody think, you know, obviously you can't take a piece of paper covered with soot and work from that, can you? Because it would just smudge the minute you touched it. So if you were faced with this problem, how would you sort of fix it so that you could work on it? Has anybody got any ideas?
As we identified the applicant's report today, the infiltration
happened.
Yeah, a little bit close, yes. Wax suggestion in the front here. So the question is, how would you do it? And if you just plonked it in wax, it would sort of. Of course, they didn't have sprays full of lacquer or seats in those days. And the first time I collected seismic data, I used a field portable instrument of this sort. And what we had was a kind of dish, made of metal, so it was like this. And you poured into it a liquid which was some pure alcohol with lacquer dissolved in it. And then you took hold of the drum and you spun it around and you dipped it down into this liquid and it covered itself with this liquid, and then you put it back on the rack and let it dry, and then you had a lacquer covered sheet of paper. And you peeled it off and measured the data. The first time I ever did any seismological field work, when I had an MSc, was up in the north of Iceland when there was a rifting episode going on and a big earthquake swarm accompanying it. And we took four of these instruments up there, and we had to go on snowmobiles up to the field area with all this junk packed on the back, and set these instruments up. And then when we outlandish experiment. When it came to changing the paper, which had to be done once every 24 hours, it was usually raining or snowing or something like this, so it wasn't possible to do that very easily in the field, so we built igloos. We just used a shovel to carve out a cave in a snowdrift somewhere, and we did it inside the snowdrift. Might even have some pictures of that somewhere. So things got cleaned up a little bit after that, and the next generation of recording paper was photographic. So this would have photographic paper on it, and there'd be a little beam of light shining on this paper and moving from one end of it to the other on a 24-hour basis as the drum turned around. The snag with this was that the paper was very expensive, so you'd order a bunch of paper that was thick, and you know that might cost £20, and it would weigh I don't know what, and it was just you know quite a drain on the money. And we used to have a seismograph of this sort here in Durham, so I don't know if anybody knows where the observatory building is on Observatory Hill, do you? Just next door to the observatory building, there's a kind of flat roof. It looks almost like a concrete pad, and it's kind of about this high. And what that is the seismic vault. And if you go around the corner there, there's a little flight of stairs and a door into it, and there's an underground vault there. And it used to have all the kind of fittings for a seismograph. And I went in there once before it was turned into PhD. Cubicles for physics PhD students, and I don't know how they managed to work there. They were just kind of in this underground cave with no windows. I don't know what the room is used for now, but I'll have to ask. But there used to be a custom built plinth for Durham's seismograph, and this was essentially a great big hole in the ground with a concrete plinth, and this concrete plinth would sit on the ground. And there would be a kind of rubber sealant around the edges joining the plinth to the floor. So the plinth was essentially decoupled from the floor. So when you walked across the floor to do whatever you needed to do with the seismograph, you change the paper or whatever, your footsteps were not shaking up the actual pillar that the seismograph was sitting on. It was sort of separate. Okay, this is the next generation of instruments. This is the vertical instrument. This is one of the horizontals, and this one at the back here is the other horizontal, so we're moving on probably 20 or 30 years in this. You can see that this instrument here is at right angles to this one here at the back, so one of these is the north-south and the other is the east-west component. So we're getting down to quite a compact situation here. This looks like a stack of paper, seismograph paper. So we've just got one small table. Instead of having three large plinths like this, we've got everything sitting on one table and much more compact in size. But when I visited, I don't know, 5 years ago, something like that, all the business was being done by this one thing here. This is a three-component broadband seismometer sitting just on the same plinth here with these old seismographs. So, you know, this huge basement with multiple rooms and sitting bays and this, that and the other, could just be reduced to something the size of a broom closet with this tiny instrument in it. Such has been the technological advances. When I started my PhD, however, new advance was actual field portable instruments. So broadband seismometers didn't exist three decades ago, and if you wanted to go somewhere out in the sticks and deploy instruments for rifting events and things like that on an opportunistic basis, then this was not a very easy thing to do. My supervisor had set up such a field portable network and for his PhD days, and he'd run into quite a lot of trouble because we have different problems nowadays, don't we? He'd run into quite a lot of problems because the equipment was very cumbersome, and it was all laid out with wires connecting different components and so forth. And their main problem was that sheep would come along and eat the wires. So this was a difficulty that I had to overcome, so I had to design a portable setup that didn't have any bare wires, and that's not as easy as you might think. Anyway, round about this time, the instruments were starting to get smaller. So in the practical session, I'll bring you to show you one of the seismometers, which was just a little bit earlier than the generation that I used. So the generation that I used were roughly this size, so about this big here, 2 or 3 kilograms. So it was still, you know, moderate deal. You know, it was a significant thing that you had to pack into the field. But prior to that, they were this big and weighed an awful lot more than that. So they became quite small round about this time, and these portable experiments did become possible. And the experiment that I ran for my PhD and deployed 23 stations packed into an area that was about 10 kilometres by 10 kilometres in size. And this was a groundbreaking experiment, really. This was a cutting-edge experiment because I used the most compact instruments available. We worked extremely hard. We had to kind of develop a technique for deploying these things so they could be maintained, given the resources available. And we discovered things that hadn't been discovered before, just simply because we did an experiment that was in more detail, more intensive, with twice as much instrumentation. This is one of Professor Pierce's instruments, one of her ocean bottom seismometers. Electronic. This is a strong motion seismometer. When I did my field work, everything was mechanical. Everything is electronic now. So obviously the data are of much higher quality, but on the other hand, these instruments have to be powered. And although we may have galloped ahead in computer technology and electronics, etc., 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 mobile phones and what have you, we have not galloped forward in portable power. Instruments like this are still powered using truck batteries, which have to be carried into the field. And a truck battery may weigh 20 kilograms or more, and you have to backpack this into the field with the rest of your stuff. And if the instrument itself is powered, then you're using more power and you're having to go out in the field more often and replace these truck batteries. So one experiment we did, in my PhD area, we found some rather interesting results, and we decided to come back and revisit that again with three-component digital equipment afterwards. And the experiment we designed was so ambitious with a larger number of seismometers that everybody was sent on a weightlifting course so that they could pack the equipment into the field. Okay, this is a strong ground motion seismometer. This is a very, very, very insensitive seismometer. Okay, so a seismometer like this will sit in the field for years, if not decades, measuring nothing. And the reason this is important is because most seismometers, right up until the recent generation of broadband seismometers, most seismometers will go off scale if there is strong ground motion. So if you're in the epicentral zone of a destructive earthquake, all your instruments will saturate. You won't know how large the amplitude of ground motion is. And this is very inconvenient for engineers, because if they want to design buildings that are earthquake proof, they need to know how strong the ground acceleration in the vertical and horizontal sense will be, so that they can calculate what materials and what design to use for their buildings. If everything's gone off scale, then you can't do this. So one colleague of mine fought long and hard to buy a set of these instruments and deploy them in the San Francisco area. People in the San Francisco area, it's very important to them, obviously, to know how strong they need to build their buildings. But even so, it was still quite difficult to get money for a project where you don't expect to get any data for 10 or 20 years, even. Okay, I've got one of these that I use the doorstop in my room. I'll bring it down so you can have a look at it in the practical. Warmore Mark II seismometer. These ceased to be used in the late 1970s. When you see it, you'll know why. I was glad I didn't have to use those in my field area. This is a portable paper drum recorder. When I started work in this field, the seismometers we took into the field were these sooted ones, but the ones that we had indoors had little bottles of ink, and they had pens which were long, narrow wire tubes, and they just drew an ink line on a piece of paper. It wasn't photographic. And we were on such a low budget that it was hardly even possible to forge sheets of paper on these seismometers, and so we placed an enormous order with a firm that made paper liners for waste paper baskets. And so this paper that we use for actually bin liners. You have to be pretty committed if you want to be a scientist. Always working on pennies. Calibration. If you're doing detailed work, you need to know the calibration of the seismometer. If you're just locating an earthquake, just wanting to know the arrival times, then fair enough, you don't need to worry. But for many other more sophisticated seismological applications, you need to know, you know, if you've got a signal this size on your seismometer, you know, how much did the ground move? And typically you would be given some sort of calibration chart like this. So this is showing a 1 second period up to a 1,000 second period, and it's showing the gain here. And this shows the frequency response of various different types of seismometer, Milne-Shaw, Amanika, Bosch, Amory, and so on and so forth. And you would look at a bunch of these and you would decide what instrument was most suitable for your application. Nowadays you don't get a chart like that, you get a table of numbers which are known as poles and zeros. And this briefly explains what poles and zeros are. So this shows the response function of any seismometer can be expressed as the ratio of two polynomials, which are a function of frequency. So x and u, this is the output and the input signal as a function of frequency. And you can write these out as, you know, long polynomials like this. And you can expand these polynomials to get something like this, with a constant factor in front, and then frequency 1, Z1, frequency 1, Z2, and so on and so forth. And what you're given when you buy an instrument is these Zs. These are known as the zeros, and Ps, which are known as the poles. So the Zs are known as zeros, because if any of these Zs is equal to the frequency, then this expression is zero. These are known as poles because if any of these p's are equal to the frequency, then this expression is infinity. So you just get this chart of numbers which describes a frequency response of your seismometer. And this is expanded upon in the lay textbook that I've recommended to you. If you have more poles and zeros, then you have a sort of tighter response frequency, that one like this. And if you have fewer poles and zeros, you get a broader frequency response like that. Nowadays, the name of the game is broadband seismometers. The last big experiment I did, research proposals were written assuming that 10% of the stations we would deploy would be broadband, because they were quite rare, very expensive, £10,000 each. But by the time the experiment got started, we deployed 100% broadband seismometers, because they just kind of swept the board. It's just amazing when some new piece of technology comes along and you initially think, oh my God, that's so expensive, that's never going to take off. But somehow or other, the money is always found. I often wonder where the money came from for everybody to have two or three mobile phones, some of them costing hundreds of pounds, because people didn't used to have mobile phones, everyone had gotten without them, and all of a sudden when they came along, everybody found them such fun and useful that all of a sudden everybody had hundreds of pounds to pay for them. Mystery to me. Anyway, broadband seismometers do have their advantages. They're not necessary for all applications. They often get used when they're not necessary, just because everybody thinks they're the best thing. They do have a lot of advantages. They have a flat response over a very broad range. So the earlier seismometers I've shown you, they would be carefully tuned to be very sensitive to one frequency. The ones that I was deploying to monitor geothermal earthquakes were very sensitive and adjusted so that they responded well at approximately 1 second frequency. By the time you got to 10 seconds, there wasn't much signal left. So they had quite a narrow range. But broadband seismometers seconds. So you can just plonk any size number for that. It doesn't matter what your target is, you know that you'll collect the data you need from these size monitors. And if something interesting happens, you know, when you're that you don't expect during your experiment, then you will have captured those signals, even though you hadn't planned to do so in the beginning. They have a high dynamic range because of a forced feedback system. So, you know, all seismometers essentially have this ball on a spring situation. And if you have a large earthquake occurring nearby, you know, the masses will typically just hit the stops because these instruments are not very big. There might be half a centimetre of motion that the ball can achieve. But if you have a forced feedback situation, which is powered again, whenever the ball or the mass moves off centre, the electronics try to force it back onto centre. So the motion can be much, much, much stronger before the thing is driven to its limit. Okay, they have a digital output, of course, so once you've collected the data, you just put it into a computer and you just filter out what you're not interested in. We'll be looking at paying a little visit to a WWSSN station shortly, Worldwide Standard Seismograph Network. This was a network that was put in all over the world by the Americans to monitor nuclear testing. In particular, during the Cold War, America and Russia, of course, were interested in the nuclear testing done by the other side, and this was done by seismic monitoring. So a WWSSN station would involve three short-period seismometers and three long-period seismometers. And this is the period sensitivity of those instruments, and this is the gain. So the short-period ones, obviously, were sensitive to short-period. The long-period ones were sensitive to long-period. So you'd have to have six large instruments. And this required two or three large rooms to house. So you might need an amount of space that was equivalent to about half of this room, at least, to have these great big plinths concreted down, preferably onto bedrock with little gaps round about them. You'd have to have two of these that have to be temperature and climate controlled. You'd need some sort of timekeeping system. And then you'd need somewhere to store all the consumables. However, one little instrument about that size, just stuck in a broom cupboard somewhere, would have a frequency response, you know, just as indicated by this envelope here. So it would completely encapsulate all the periods to which the short period and the long period thing was sensitive, and you just need the one instrument. Now here are a few different sorts. Inside. So I think this was a CMG3T, and very shortly thereafter, I mean the rate of technology development was just kind of breathtaking. Every year there was something new came out, and this is an even more compact one, the size that my colleagues and I deployed in Long Valley Caldera in a experiment there to monitor earthquakes. So we had five or six of these, plus other kinds of instruments, and sometimes they broke down, and so it's very tempting to open them up and have a poke around, see if you can fix them. And this is what you are faced with. This is one component here, this is a second component, and the other component is around the back. So, broadband sensors, they're digital. The reason the WWSSN stations had the short period instruments and the long period instruments was because they wanted both kinds of signal. But if you just had one instrument that was recording it, then both these signals would be mixed up together. Obviously, you just have the one record, and you couldn't digitally filter it to get out the signal you wanted. So it had to be recorded on different instruments. Of course, we use GPS timekeeping now, which has completely got rid of all timekeeping problems, but this is not the case before. And people used to spend a lot of time making clock corrections and things like that to BBC time pips in order to data is not only recorded digitally, but it's loaded straight up onto the internet, so somebody can deploy a station in one place and people all over the world can immediately start analysing the data. Back in the days of the worldwide standard seismograph network, people would gather the records maybe for 3 months or however, and then they'd read all the seismic records, and then they'd send them to Golden, Colorado for central processing, because obviously you need the records from all of the worldwide stations. And sometimes it would take 2 years between data being recorded in a very remote station somewhere, you know, Africa or somewhere like that. It would take 2 years before the data were got and added into the database. Once the paper records from the WWSSN had been analysed, they would be sent back to the station for storage there. However, this old stuff was fairly cheap and nowadays it's fairly expensive. So the experiment that I did for my PhD probably cost, of course it was a while ago, but it was probably done for £20,000 or £30,000, whereas nowadays if you want to do a seismic experiment, you better start thinking in terms of £1 or £2 million. Okay, so in a large experiment that my colleagues and I staged to look for mantle structure beneath Iceland, we deployed a lot of seismic stations all over Iceland. And those of you who attend the Challenges in Geodynamics module will know that we made a little teaching video of this experiment. And I'm just going to show you a chapter of that where we visited a worldwide standard seismograph network in Iceland. Okay, get this up. So we deployed something like 35 broadband stations all over Iceland. Some of these were deployed in the interior, and there was usually quite a challenge in finding somewhere to deploy it because, as I mentioned, these things needed power. So if there was no mains electricity, and most of the interior of Iceland is not inhabited, so you know, we were faced with most of Iceland not having mains electricity, so we used a lot of solar panels. And even at other places, power was needed, and we needed somewhere reasonably quiet. The instrument was going to be in place for 2 to 3 years, so you couldn't just stuff it in someone's backyard and come back at the end of the summer and remove it. It was a kind of semi-permanent fixture. And one place where we deployed the seismometer was at the WWSSN station in the north of Iceland in a town called Akureyri. And this station was originally set up by the Americans about 50 years ago to house their WWSSN station that was part of their bomb detection project. So here we go. Ah, we want sound, don't we? Let me see if I can get that on the road.
Hello, hello. Welcome in.
This is Geesley, the police chief. It's in the police station.
How's the station, Geesley?
Oh, it's good.
Is it? Oh, it's great. Shall we go have a look at it?
Yeah.
The Akureyri police station was a sort of shack somewhere on the hillside, and they wanted to make a new building, and so the town was discussing where the money was going to come from. And then the Americans came along and they offered to build the ground floor of it, the ground floor, if they could house their seismometer station in the basement. And so I asked Geesley, you know, this is nuclear detection work, Cold War technology, so did people realise that this is where the money was coming from? It was coming from the American military. Oh no, they kept that a big secret. No, we didn't know that at the time. And then when I interviewed him, he said, oh yes, everybody knew that. Wasn't clear to me whether he knew where this money was coming from or not. But, so, let's proceed. proceed. So this shows why they had six instruments. There are three short period ones and three long period ones. And this shows the frequency. This just shows ground noise. And if we, you know, measured somewhere here in Durham, there was no earthquake, or anywhere in the world, you would get something similar to this. At very long periods, the ground noise is down at some particular level here, and at long periods, let's get this right here, shall we? This is the long period, and this is short period. So we have relatively low noise level here, and a relatively low noise level here, although it is actually somewhat higher, but there's a kind of peak of noise in this range here, from sort of roundabout, it's peaking round about 6 seconds period. And these are known as microseisms, and they're caused by wave motion in the oceans. So the oceans are constantly using wave motion, and on land you get this huge peak of noise round about 6 seconds, and it swamps everything else. So when we process broadband data nowadays, we filter out this huge peak of noise there, because otherwise it would drown all our signals. But of course, when things were recorded on paper, you couldn't do that. If you just had one station, one seismometer that was sensitive to this period here, you would hardly see any earthquakes at all. You would just see noise from the ocean. People sometimes use the word microseism to mean a microearthquake. In the industry, when they're talking about fracking-related earthquakes and things like this, they love to call them micro-earthquakes or micro-seisms. Saying micro-seism is exactly, you know, wrong thing, because a micro-seism is a noise, a source of noise from the ocean. But the industry likes to call them micro-earthquakes because it makes it sound as though they're small and not going to do any harm. Of course, this is not always the case. So, in fact, this is why there were two sets of instruments in the WWSSN network, because the long-period ones recorded signals here, and the short-period ones recorded signals here, and so this big noise source was just simply eliminated because no instrument was sensitive to it. So this is what a broadband record looks like. It just looks like a continuous measurement of noise, and these are the six-second microsizes. If we take a bunch of that and we expand it up, here you see, if you were to count the seconds along here, you would see that this has got a period of approximately 6 seconds. And we can see there's a little micro, I'm doing it myself now, there's a small earthquake which is kind of riding on the back of this 6 second noise here. And if we filtered the 6 second noise out, you would just see a regular small earthquake signal. And here we are again looking at what looks like just a bunch of noise. But if we filter out that key period band where the noise is, then you can see that there's a rather well-recorded telesignal hidden away inside it. Okay, here we're looking at a short period record of a, let's see now, this is an earthquake at a distance of about 800 kilometers. So it's a fairly large regional earthquake. This is a short period record. This is a long period record of it, and this is what the broadband record looks like. Okay, we now have a lot more sophisticated global networks than just the WWSSN. Most of them have now got broadband records, and there's been a tremendous lot of international diplomacy to set up these networks. It's a real kind of a uniter of everybody. When you meet scientists from whatever country, people are just simply not interested in the politics. Everybody gets along really well because everybody has got a common goal, which is pursuing the science. So here's a station from Kyrgyzstan, and this looks like a broadband instrument to me. So this, I guess, is all the obsolete older instruments. This is in the Australian Antarctic. Again, there are older instruments here, and this certainly here is a broadband seismometer, so it may well be that this one's running and maybe the others are even switched off. Here we have the station in Iceland, a little fence around it to keep the sheep out, big problem in Iceland. And this is a station in Siberia that Professor Julian and I had the privilege of visiting a little while ago. So here's Professor Julian. You may have seen him floating around in my room just recently. This gentleman here is the husband of the person who runs it. So here we've got a typical Siberian structure here made of logs of wood, and it's sitting on this outcrop because the plinth that the seismometers are on is concreted straight onto a rock outcrop. And here's the inside of it. These are Russian instruments. So I did not recognize any of these instruments here. There was something of a language barrier, so I never got to find out what they were called. And this is looking away from that little hut at the building here where the signals are received. So there's a cable running from the hut over to this building here. And this was a real kind of cultural eye-opener to stay with these people. I was on my way into the field near the Mongolian border where I was going to check out with some colleagues of mine a volcanic area which might have been of interest for geothermal development. And we stayed, it was a 4-day journey to get to this field site, much of it riding in the back of an open truck with CCCP written on the side, so it's kind of, I don't know how old that truck was. But we stayed one night in this house here, and the gentleman that you saw a picture of earlier, he seemed to spend most of his time cutting wood and piling it up, because I suppose the Siberian winter, months that lasts, maybe 9, and a huge quantity of wood is needed because the little house in which the family lived was heated with wood. And his wife was the main breadwinner of the family. She ran the seismograph station, and the arrangement there was that if an earthquake was recorded, there was electricity running into the house, as you could see, and there was a PC of some kind there, a computer. If the computer recognised an earthquake, a bell would ring, and she would have to get up at any time of the night and day and read the PNS wave arrival times and radio them to Moscow. So she was in charge of this station. However, despite the fact there was this high-tech seismic station and a computer in the house itself had got no domestic electricity and no running water, and the lavatory was a dry pit out in the backyard, and the water used for cooking and washing had to be carried in buckets every day. The lady, that was one of her 3 jobs. She also baked bread with which she supplied the local village, and she had a brick oven in the backyard, quite a long way from the house, and she would bake 20 or 30 loaves of bread every day, and these supply the village. And her 3rd job was that she was a teacher of mathematics in the high school in the town, and so although the house had got no electricity and no running water, it did have piles of mathematics books and treatises on Euclidean geometry and things like that piled up everywhere. So I got the impression that the people were very highly educated, but they hadn't necessarily had the full benefit that you might hope to get from such education. Anyway, so here we have this great international cooperative effort, and here's a diagram showing one permanent global network, and you can go online and find lots of other examples of, you know, strong ground motion networks and things like that. We are starting to get more and more stations in the oceans, although there are vast areas of the oceans which are devoid of seismic stations. There are plenty on the land. But, you know, there's a tremendous lot that we don't know about the structure of the interior of the Earth simply because so many parts of the world are not yet instrumented. And then there's US Array. I got myself together this morning and I downloaded the latest station map of the US Array network. So this is a huge project. An enormous amount of money was acquired to buy about... by about 2,000 seismic stations, and they were all deployed to begin with here in the western USA, and the stations were leapfrogged gradually over one another over a period of about 10 years, and now the whole of the USA has been covered with stations. So many of these stations are not existing now because they've been leapfrogged and the hardware has been moved, but the entire USA has been covered with this mega network, and this is the biggest experiment ever staged to study the structure of the mantle. So this is quite a big deal. You need a backhoe, you need money. The entire experiment has cost something like $500 million, so we're talking kind of space mission sized chunks of money. So this, I think when some branches of the US government do things, they tend to make them much more elaborate and expensive than they need to. I mean, if we had deployed all of our stations in Iceland like that, it would have been out of the question that we could have done the work we did. You know, we would go around and chat up the local farmer and ask if we could put his station, you know, in a barn somewhere, and we'd just pay him some small amount of money and send him a newsletter every 6 months, and everybody was happy. So but putting something in like this is going to cost $30,000 probably. Fences, solar panels, disasters. And the data is stored by an organisation called IRIS, the IRIS Data Management Centre. And if any of you are interested in, you know, if you wake up one day and you feel an earthquake and you think, oh, that's interesting, you know, you can go to the IRIS Data Management Centre and you can just download the seismograms showing that earthquake. And I think there is one fourth year group of earth sciences into schools who are... they're actually liaising with a school to set up some kind of school earthquake project. And this, I must remember to tell them about IRIS, because there's this educational resources link that you can click here, and there's all sorts of amazing stuff there that can be used for educational purposes, every map and earthquake record that you could possibly ask for. But what I tend to be mostly involved in is smaller scale experiments where you can actually... you get to do something yourself rather than just sitting in an armchair downloading data over the internet. It's not that long ago since a student applied for a PhD with me and said, oh, you know, I'd like to do some field work. I don't want to spend my whole PhD just sitting in front of a computer. But, you know, I don't think anybody would dream of saying such a thing anymore, because you know, we're all going to spend our entire lives spending all our time sitting behind computers. This is the COSO geothermal area, California. We have a PhD student who is studying data from there now. This is how the data were collected. Here we have an extremely cheap way of digging a hole. This is what we use to interrogate the instruments, which are installed in a large cooler chest which was bought in the local supermarket. And this was probably borrowed for free from somewhere. And we have the This person was borrowed for free, as well as the equipment. It's possible to keep the costs down. And here we have another experiment. Here we were installing a station in a geothermal area in Nevada called Desert Peak. Here's Professor Julian again taking these very important field notes. All the recorder and the disc and everything is contained in this box. And this is the GPS clock, which is just sitting in the sand there. And that's about it. So let's take a break. And we'll start the practical at 10 minutes past.